Today's segment of Sound Balming is brought to you by Jimmy and Mary's Authentic Body Care. I cannot express to you how much we love, love, love their products. Although we use them all year, as the weather gets colder, we need these products even more. The dreaded drop in temperature, the dryness, the itchiness, and the unnecessary flakiness is inevitable. Shea Butter from Jimmy and Mary's Authentic Body Care is the only thing that works for my skin and hair needs. Not only do these products cure my dry skin, the whipped butter goes on smoothly and doesn't leave that uncomfortably thick, sticky residue. Bonus? It smells absolutely amazing. There are so many different scents to choose from too. Not only do they carry skincare products, there are products for authentic living, face, shower, hair and beard, spritzers and perfumes, and bath products. Let me tell you, we cannot even keep the stuff in the studio. The entire production team, as well as all our children, use Jimmy and Mary's product. Jimmy and Mary's take pride in creating quality, handcrafted products from simple ingredients for the entire family. Their products are made for all skin types and are 100% handmade, 100% vegan, and 100% cruelty-free. Skincare is important. Moisture is key, and keeping our skin and hair hydrated is essential. I cannot emphasize how much we trust Jimmy and Mary's for all of our skincare needs. Hurry on up to jimmyandmarys.com and check out their products. Did I mention service is fast and efficient too? Don't forget to mention that you heard about Jimmy and Mary's authentic skincare on Sound Balming. Use the discount code SOUNDBALM20 to get 15% off. That's SOUNDBALM20 for 15% off at Jimmy and Mary's Authentic Skin Care.
Hey everybody, welcome to Sound Balming. I created this show for people who want to experience a radical, life-changing journey through the sounds of my diverse guests. I hope that each sound you hear on this show will strengthen your faith, encourage your dreams, and challenge you to awaken the greatness within you.
Drop the bomb.
Drop the bomb.
We're going to drop the bomb.
Drop the bomb.
We're going to drop the bomb.
Drop the bomb.
We come to drop the bomb.
Drop the bomb.
This is a journey into sound. A journey which along the way will bring to you new color, new dimension, new values, and a new experience.
Ladies and gentlemen, the star of the show,
Lamar Darnell Shields.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever the time of the day it is. Welcome to my show. I am your host, Dr. Lamar Darnell Shields, in the building. I'm always in the building because it's COVID, of course, and you need to be in the building. Who am I? I'm the creator of Sound Bombing, and my goal with this show is to introduce you to people with ideas that will help you unlock your full potential. And you all know me. I love, love, love a great story. The great Mark Twain said, I like a good story well told. That is the reason I am sometimes forced to tell them myself. Well, Mark Twain is not the only person who tells amazing stories. My next guest, Corey Johnson, is amazing. Corey is an author who is on the fast track to becoming a prolific writer and storyteller. I may say not on a fast track. I think he's there. Through his writing, Corey takes his readers on a detailed journey into stories, all while allowing room for the reader to use their own imagination and their own visions. While reading his books, you'll find yourself wanting to know more and more and more about the characters and the lives they portray. His books are intellectually well-written, yet the words jump off the page very easily to any reader. His first book, P.I. Chronicles, is a memoir series about his life as a young Marine stationed in Subic Bay, Philippines. His second book published, Courageous, which we're going to be talking about, this now turned into a award-winning play, is about his older brother, Avon Johnson. In his writing of this book, he talks about how important it was to share his brother's story, especially growing up in a city, growing up a city like Baltimore City that's very violent, not only in the 70s and 80s, but right now. I'm so excited that he's joining me in the Bomb Shelter today. Put your hands together for my man, the prolific writer, my man, Corey Johnson in the building. Brother, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you. That was a great introduction, man. I don't think I've ever been introduced like that before.
Hey, my goal when I bring people into the studio, man, not physically, but spiritually into the space, because we know it's COVID, is to let people know that I got some dope people in my phone book, in my iPhone, dope people in my circle. And you are one of them. You and I have a lot of things in common, but one of them is writing. Love, you know, a passion for film, a passion also for the stage. Man, we got a lot to unpack today. We got a lot of stories going on. Speaking of stories, man, hey, one of the stories that just unreleased, it's being released all over the country, is more killings of African-American men and women unarmed. As a writer, before we get into your stuff, man, what are some things that you're writing about as you look at stories like this on a day-to-day basis?
Well, that's a great segue, because I'm actually currently working on a piece about COVID. You know, as you know, I had a very, very dear family member pass away recently from COVID. And I think I will be remiss as a writer if I didn't try to tell, you know, at least part of his story. His story was something I wanted to talk about before he passed away, because he battled with a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And after the COVID incident, I decided to, you know, get to my computer. And while it was fresh in my head, I started laying the foundation for what I thought would be a story that the world needs to hear about how COVID affects, you know, Black people. He suffered from COVID for about 3 weeks, and he actually owned. And I like to write intimate pieces, like one person, you know, monologue type pieces where the person can give you their perspective. So, you know, that's what's going on in the world today. And, you know, that's something that touched me. I can't write unless I'm inspired about something. So that inspired me. It sparked something to make me want to write.
Well, I'm honored, man, that you are writing my brother Antoine Buster Ball's story. A brother who I have a lot of love and respect for, you know, ran my school at Johns Hopkins. We started a school for boys called the Paul Robeson Academy. My brother Antoine and I traveled to Puerto Rico together. We traveled to Atlanta together. We traveled all over the country together, was on our way to Haiti and other places to continue our work. And so I'm glad that you're going to elevate his story, because his story is very, very a personal, not only to the both of us, but then his story is relatable to all the people around the country. So I'm glad that you are going to do that. Speaking of that, Corey, when did you first realize you wanted to be a writer, become a writer?
Well, I went to Warburg High School for art and communication. I always had the ability to be creative. I used to draw and paint when I was young, so I was able to go to gifted and talented programs and things like that. I went to Warburg for art communication, so I learned more about the different types of art. And I stopped doing it for a while. I guess you could say I transferred that talent and interest in art to music. I was a DJ when I was young, and you know, I was very much into hip hop and all of those things. And later on in my life, I would say maybe around 2000 and I don't know, 12, maybe 10, something like that. I started writing about my life as a young Marine who left Baltimore and traveled around the world. I went to places like the Philippines, and I felt like some of my Marine friends, we talked about how unless you were in the Marines or traveled in the military, you wouldn't know what that life was like. So I wanted to, you know, share that story with people by writing my own book. So as I was writing the book and people was reading the manuscript, somebody mentioned to me that, there was a story that was more compelling than mine, which was about my brother, you know, being a guy in the streets in Baltimore. And initially, I didn't want to write it because, you know, we have a lot of Black cult tale stories about drug dealers and violence in Baltimore. So I didn't want to write that story. But through my research, I found out that it was a story of redemption. Not only was he a gangster and a notorious guy in the streets of Baltimore, but he became a drug addict. And at some point he beat his addiction and he turned his life around to use his influence to help people. So that made the story more interesting. So in writing the story, I can't justify the redemptive part in saying what he did well unless I told the story about where he came from first. So I had to reveal the intricate details and the intimate details about him being a drug dealer so that it would be justified that, you know, he was really that person that came from that life. So it ended up being a great story. You know, it's called Courageous.
Well, since you jumped right into Courageous, I have not got a chance to read the book, but I did virtually get a chance to see this amazing, amazing book go onto the stage and the amazing actor whose name I cannot think of right now, who just elevated the story of your brother. We're going to take a look at a clip from the play Courageous, which was inspired by your book. And I'm going to bring you back and I want you to talk about this prolific scene in the play.
The doc. The doctors told me that I have AIDS. That I have HIV. Now they say that HIV comes from a man having sex with another man. A man being gay. Well, I'm not gay. So I don't know nothing about that. What I do know is you can get HIV/AIDS from sharing needles. I mean, me and my friends, and we did it all the time, getting high. We would share needles. Now, I have HIV. And it's because of that decision and that decision alone that I may not live to see my fourth year anniversary.
All right, so Corey, tell me about the play and the book Courageous, and what is it about that scene in the play that really, 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 really gets people to think deep about what's going on? What was going on in your brother's mind and his life at that point in time?
So in this particular scene we just watched, the character Flubber he's basically telling his life story at an NA meeting. He's pleading to the audience that you don't have to continue to go through a life of drug addiction. You know, he's already recovered, and he's at an NA meeting, and he's telling his life story about how he got from being rock bottom to being a recovering drug addict. And he's pleading to the audience saying, use my life as an example. You don't have to do those things because I've done it already. You don't have to try to go out there and see what it's like. I'm telling you what it's like personally from my personal experience. And he breaks down in tears because, you know, he feel like the best way to tell these people how real this drug addiction is to tell them what they will call the gut honest truth. And this is a period piece. So this happens in the 80s. What happened is he acquired HIV through intravenous needle use. You know, back then, the use of needles in the streets was different than what people use today. They were using, you know, big, steel, hard, you know, needles where you could actually transfer to diseases. And he acquired HIV. So he's telling the people, listen, if you don't really get what I'm saying, I'm here to tell you that I have HIV, and it's straight from using needles and getting high, and I might not be here next year. So listen to what I'm saying, because this might be my last time to even, you know, be in front of you to tell you this. And the actor pulls it off in such a magnificent way. He makes it so believable because he actually starts crying. And I feel like that's a very pivotal moment in the story, and you know, it was just very touching and poignant, you know, that the guy was able to pull that off. We've done performances of that play where people actually thought the actor was Flubber. Flubber passed away in 91. This is an actor portraying him, but he did such a great job that at the end of the play, people come up to him and say, man, you know, I'm sorry to hear you have HIV. You know, this, that, and the third, because they really believe.
That's a real actor when you take on a role. Now, let's back up. You keep saying the name Flubber. My listeners are like, who in the hell is Flubber? Please explain to our listeners who Flubber is, where his name comes from, and in the order of the siblings, where is he within the order of the siblings?
So I'm the youngest. Flubber was the second oldest. This was the time period, you know, my older brothers were born in the late 40s, 50s, and they lived their life out through the 60s, 70s, 80s. So Flubber's the second oldest, but he was like the...
Now, let our listeners know, Flubber wasn't the name on his birth certificate, Corey. Like, when he came out, your mama didn't name him Flubber, right? Tell him where the name came from.
and I put that in the book as well. Yeah. His name was Avon. And that's a great point you bring about. So I'm the youngest. I knew him as my older brother, Avon. Around the house, he was a funny guy. He was very charismatic. He walked in the room. He was loud, you know, boisterous. That's who I knew. He dressed nice. He carried himself well. But in the streets, he was known as Flubber. That was his name out in the streets. That was a name that he acquired out in the streets. Back in the day, there was a movie called The Nutty Professor. And The Nutty Professor created this chemical compound that could not be destroyed, no matter what you did to it. So he got the nickname Flubber because they considered him to be like the chemical compound Flubber. He was indestructible. Nobody could touch him. Nobody could do anything to him. He was afraid of nothing. When he played football, he would run guys over. They would bounce off him. So people called him Flubber. But his name was Avon Johnson. He was a very notorious, well-known guy in the streets of West Baltimore.
So let's go back to that scene, Corey. Powerful scene. I saw the piece. Very powerful, very, very emotional piece. I want to talk about you watching that over and over again. What does that do to you and to your family members and to his children? He had more than one child. Let's start with you. When you watch that, because I do a lot of work around trauma-informed care and trauma, you know, seeing it over and over again, what does that do to you? Because I heard you say how people walked up to the actor and was like, man, I'm sorry this happened to you. But this was your brother. This is someone portraying your brother, but you watched this thing play out in real time. What does it do to you when you watch that film, watch the play in real time, and even when you read the words? And what does it do to the family members as well?
Well, for me, you know, I look at everything through a different lens. You know, I have to look at it through my director lens. My job is to bring forth a story that's going to be compelling and interesting and evoke conversation and thought for people to see something that maybe they've never seen before. But it has to come across in a realistic performance. So for me, I just critique the performance and how it's brought and delivered. As a brother and a family member, I've gotten past the emotional part of it a long time ago. I was in the house. We lived in the same house when Flubber passed away. You know, one of his close friends, Al Wiley, performed the funeral, and he came to the house and picked him up. He's like a family friend, you know. So I've gone through all of that. You know, I watched Flubber suffer through his addiction. I watched him suffer through battling HIV, and he died in the house. So, you know, I had to deal with all of that emotion, and I'm the type of person, I deal with it kind of on a personal, you know, in my quiet space.
Are some lessons that you learned watching your brother go through this transition? This guy who was like a Superman, you know, he took on this character from Nutty Professor, saying, I can't be destroyed. You know, I can't be recreated. But then he eventually died to an addiction that he helped actually fuel the street. Right. He was known as a hustler. But what are some of the lessons that you learned from the last part of his life as he began to transition and almost just to fade? Because he wasn't this guy, you know, that you saw, you know, out there on the streets hustling, and he had this really, really big name. What did that teach you about watching him go through this process?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. You know, he was my superhero. You know, he was the guy that was indestructible. He was the flashiest guy. He wore the nicest clothes. You know, he drove the best car, you know, in the neighborhood. And I watched him, you know, approach people and handle things like a man would out in the street. So to see his demise and the way he was basically crippled by his drug addiction, and then the HIV on top of that, it was devastating. You know what I mean? It was really devastating to watch that in real time. But it was a dignity about it because of the way he carried himself. You know, he didn't want sympathy. You know, he fought till his last breath. He still wanted to look sharp. You know, he would look in the mirror and still tell you that, you know, like Muhammad Ali, that he thought he was the best looking guy in the room, you know. And so he taught me those lessons about how to take care of myself, how to be a man and under all circumstances to still carry yourself with dignity and pride, you know. But as a family member and a brother, it was very painful to watch. But again, he stood so tall, you know, he always stood 10 toes, you know what I mean, no matter what. And that's something I always admire. The drug addiction part of it, I have to say that as a young brother, he never exposed me to that. He actually protected me from it. You know, he made sure I wasn't a part of that life. You know, we never talked about it. He never had it around me. The neighborhood people knew that I was Flubber's little brother. I never really had to deal with that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not something that I respect about him. He used his reputation and his influence in the neighborhood to make sure that I grew up a certain way in the neighborhood. You know, and my other brothers and family members as well. People knew Flubber had a reputation, but it was painful to watch him pass away, you know, the way he did.
So how did your brother's life impact you as a writer? Talk to me about your writing process and what is that like?
So for me, I didn't go to school. I didn't learn to write through like journalism or take any literature courses or anything like that. It was really just a raw talent and a passion to tell stories. People always say I'm a good storyteller. You know, if something happened in my life, I'm the person in the family that can get the whole room's attention and tell you the story in detail from beginning to end. So I transferred that to my writing style. If you read any of my books or my plays, the scripts or manuscripts or screenplays, you'll see that I pride myself on writing a story that makes the reader feel like they're actually there in the moment. I try to give you as much detail so that you can, you know, smell the roses. You know, you can feel the temperature in the room, and you know, you can sense anything that's happening as if you were really there, just through the words. That's what I, you know, pride myself on as a writer.
So Corey, it's interesting you would say that, man. I was watching a documentary about Toni Morrison. I always trick my kids, Corey, into watching these films with me. But for whatever, it was like, oh, Baba, you gonna make us watch a documentary. But for whatever reason, my daughter, who was 11th grader, she's actually in a play called Little Women coming up this week. But we were scrolling through and we saw the Toni Morrison piece and we watched it, Corey. And I was so blown away that my daughter really, really wanted to see it. I explained to her who Toni Morrison was and how important she is to Black literature and literature to Black women. But what I loved about Toni Morrison, her stories were Black. And she took a lot of heat for that. She was very clear. I'm unapologetically a woman, a Black woman. And my stories are Black people, about Black people. And all the writings in New York Times, everybody was like, oh, she would be great if she talked about .. She fought to get the Pulitzer Prize. I mean, people like James Baldwin, Sonia Sanchez, Nikki Giovanni, they fought for her to get the Nobel Peace Prize for literature and everything. But what I loved, it was something that you said, is that, you know, I didn't have this upbringing. I didn't go to get a PhD or a master's degree in writing, but I'm writing about stories that are real, stories that are real people, stories that people can identify with, stories that they can say, man, that sounds like my uncle. That sounds like my aunt. That sounds like my cousin. That sounds like my tia in Spanish, my abuelita in Spanish. But regardless of what culture, you can find a connection. Is that important to you as a writer to let people know that these characters are real and these are people, these are everyday people, as Arrested Development actually says in one of their songs.
Absolutely. That's probably one of the most important things about my writing in particular. I mean, I have a few stories that are, you know, created that aren't real, but most of the people I write about are real people. And it means a lot to me that the reader or the audience picks that up. I want my characters to be, like you said, everyday people, Arrested Development. I want them to be able to relate to the person, you know, whether it's an older person, whether it's a younger person, whether their lifestyle is different than yours or not. At the end of the day, they're human beings. And that's one of the things about Courageous that I thought was important. Again, I didn't want to glorify the fact that he was a drug dealer and a gangster. I wanted to people to see that he's a human being. We all make mistakes. I know him as Avon, you know, nice guy, very funny, protector of the family, superhero. But I also found out that Flubber was a notorious guy. You didn't play with him. And he did some things in the streets that, you know, probably was, you know, broke some laws and did some things that people aren't supposed to do. But at the end of the day, Flubber and Avon is one person. You know what I'm saying? So my other characters, it's the same thing. I want people to see the civility in them. I want them to see, you know, the human nature in them, that we all make mistakes. We all, you know, come from a certain lifestyle. And it's something that each character, I think everybody can relate to.
You know, I love that, man. I love that you said that he's one and the same person. I mean, that makes a lot of sense as it relates to where he is and where he was, because you can... people knew him in different ways. People knew him as Flubber, as you said. People knew him as Avon. But at the core, he was still a human. And that sort of showed up at the end of the piece. Getting back to sort of your writing style, if you could tell your youngest writing self anything, Corey, your younger writing self, what would it be?
I definitely would have gone to school and got some formal training on writing. You know, when it comes to formulating stories, you know, a lot of people don't know what a protagonist, what a antagonist is, you know, what the climax is, you know, how to conjugate verbs and nouns and pronouns. It's a lot of different intricate things to storytelling that a lot of people don't know about. But at the same time, I don't want that to be intimidating to a new writer. I always tell people, I get asked all the time, how do you write a book? The best thing is to just start writing.
All right.
Get the story out of your head.
Isn't it interesting, Corey, that people think you're going to give them like this strong intellectual piece? I interviewed a woman named Jody King. She's an artist. And she says to her mentor, I want to paint. And you know what he said, right?
Paint. Start painting.
start painting. And she was like, right. No, I want to paint. He said, start painting. And I'm glad that you said that, because I'm always telling people, you know, they say, how do you eat an elephant? I don't know who eats elephant, but they say one bite at a time. And I say, write one paragraph on Monday, write one paragraph on Tuesday, write one paragraph on Wednesday, do one push-up on Monday, do one push-up on Tuesday, and you're creating this movement. But I think we do sit down and we expect this is going to be a flood of information. And I'm sure you know, like most writers out there, there's sometimes it's not. And so, you know, when those times happen, Corey, when it's not, what do you do for inspiration? Like when it's nothing happening, when you're looking at that pen or that pencil, when you're looking at that keyboard and you're like, come on now, do you force it or do you do something, you walk away from it and come back? And what is that process like?
Well, that's a great question, because I always tell people I don't force my writing. You know, I feel like it's not going to be authentic. It's not going to be real. It's not going to be Corey J. Johnson, the writer, if I force it. You know, I can make up stories every day. But again, I have to be inspired to really write something. The reason I knew Courageous and my other books, P.I. Chronicles, the reason I knew they were special was because the story flowed. I mean, I could not wait to get behind the laptop every day and start writing, you know, the next chapter or the next part of wherever I stopped off. Some days I could write for hours on hours. I had to, you know, basically step away from the computer and rest. But Courageous, the story was coming to me like it was like an out-of-body experience. I always tell people when I go back and read Courageous, I have to kind of pinch myself and, you know, did I write that? I don't even remember writing that. It was like the story was a gift. It was given to me through Flub of Spirit, you know, some kind of way there was a connection where the words of the story were given to me. And I was just a facilitator to just write it down. But other stories I create, I get inspired. Something comes to me. I feel that creative juice, so to speak. And I just go ahead and start writing it. Now, sometimes I get an idea. I don't know where the story's going. It's just an idea. And I'll write that down. That's a good tip for new writers. If you have something in your head and you're not sure, you haven't completed the full story, just write it down. Give it a title, write it down, and just save it.
Yeah, Mel Robbins has a great book out called The 5-Second Rule, where she talks about, you know, that, you know, getting that thing. I mean, you think about all the ideas that are permeating through your mind and all the thoughts as you walk around. You know, I think about Langston Hughes. There's one of my favorite restaurants they bring coming to Baltimore finally called Bus Boys and Poets. And I asked them, why'd you name it after, you know, Bus Boys and Poets? People don't know that Langston Hughes, who lived in D.C., Langston Hughes was a bus boy. And Corey, he used to write down on receipts and napkins poetry that was coming to him. So could you imagine being in a restaurant, brother, and Langston Hughes, like, man, who is this little dude or this little Negro who wrote this piece and now is valuable? So he was a busboy and he would write down this poetry, man. And like, yo, there it is. And so I'm glad that you gave them some tips on what to do when it comes to writing those things. So here's the other thing, Corey. Does writing energize or exhaust you?
It can do both, to be honest with you. But when I'm in that groove, man, when it's flowing and my fingers are going on those keys, I just it's very energizing. It's inspiring. It's motivating. I'm in a good place. You know, even when I get to a sad part of the story, as a writer, I just want to make it come across as real and believable and as authentic as possible. For Flubber, I hate to keep, you know, referencing Courageous, but because Flubber has such a notorious reputation, I couldn't write Courageous and create all of these stories that weren't real. I knew that I would get called out on it because of who Flubber was. So it was important for me that the story was authentic. So I did a lot of research with people who knew him so that I can get real stories. Now, again, you know, some of the things he did wasn't, you know, great. So, you know, sometimes you had to change names to protect the innocent, so to speak. But I still would try to get the story across of whatever that particular incident was. But in writing other stories, like I say, even if it's a sad moment, I still want it to be as authentic as possible. That's important to me.
What would you say is your interesting writing quirk? Like something that's interesting, like an interesting writing quirk that you have that other people may not have.
I don't know if it's a quirk, but I don't use a structure system when I write. I have a great recall memory. So I could be laying in bed or watching a basketball game or, you know, doing work around the house. I'm writing in my mind. You know, sort of like Jay-Z, I'm creating a story already in my mind, so I know where I'm going next. Some people who have a systematic way of writing structures, keeping notes and things like that so that they know what chapter's next and what's coming. You know, there's a formula way of writing. Even as a screenwriter, there's a certain way you're supposed to write scripts and things like that. I don't do that. I don't do the traditional style writing. I have to be true to myself, and that's what's worked for me. So if I could say it was a quirk, it's just the fact that I would say it's organized chaos, you know, but it's in my mind.
Yeah, I love you referenced Jay-Z. And one thing I love about Jay-Z has mastered the power of language. He understands language. So with that being said, what would you say is an early experience where you learned that language had power, when you learned that words had power?
To be honest with you, when I learned that words had power was when I read Alex Haley's Malcolm X. You know, that was one of the first novels that I actually completed and read from beginning to end. And it was a book that I couldn't put down, you know, and the words jumped off the page, you know, right to me. I would say my style is similar to his because he made me feel like I was there. You know, there's a scene in the book Malcolm X early on where he talks about how his father died. And it's so detailed and riveting and emotional. You know, you imagine this guy, you know, being murdered by by white Klansmen and being put on the railroad tracks, you know, to die. And man, you know, that meant a lot to me. You know, it spoke to me more than anything. So that was one of the first times that I realized that words mean a lot. The other time I would say was I'm a lover of hip hop, and my first album was Run DMC. And I was introduced to, you know, other records was playing on the radio, like The Message and stuff like that. But when I heard Sucker MCs, that was it yes. for me.
You know, it's that interesting. I'm hearing the drum in the back with Jay. You named two of my Run DMC and Malcolm X at an all time high, man. And so, you know, I want my listeners to understand and my future writers out there that words have power. And words can heal or they can actually kill. So as we begin to sort of wrap up this piece, what final message do you have, Corey, for aspiring writers, those writers who want to do it but are afraid to step out on faith, who don't believe in their gift or don't believe that their story or stories have merit? What message do you have for them?
It's just like what we talked about earlier, you know, just write it down. I believe you got to believe in yourself. You know, if you don't believe in yourself, nobody else will. Other people can support you, motivate you, encourage you. But at the end of the day, man, only you can drive the bus. You know, only you can carry your own water. So it's really up to you. Find something that interests you, man, and just go ahead and do it. You know, the world is your oyster, man. You can do anything you put your mind to. I would say, you know, start off with something small. You know, there are certain things called shorts, and there's a lot of different writing styles. Everybody don't write the same. Even in poetry, there's a lot of different complex and intimate and long drawn out ways to write poetry. It just depends on what your style is. It doesn't appeal to everybody. It's just like music. You got different genres of music. They don't all appeal to everybody. So find what appeals to you. And just go ahead and do it. Write it in small segments and then have somebody else read it. You know, that's the advice that I would give.
So what are some upcoming projects that you are working on right now that you want to share with the audience? And then I know something is happening with the film, with the book Courageous, the film, the book, the play. Something is coming down the pike real soon, right?
Yeah, so I've been, you know, we've been stuck in the house. We haven't been able to really get out and film. You know, I try to be safe and not encourage people to come out and be in close proximity. So I've put all my film and play products on hold. But with that being said, I'm sitting on several really, really good stories, scripts about some plays and different stories that I want to put out there. So besides those things, like I mentioned, I'm writing a piece about Antoine and his demise and his battle with COVID. I don't know if it's going to be made public. It may be just something therapeutic for me just to write and hold on to. My primer.
The Super Bomb questions are brought to you by Mountain Made CBD. Mountain Made is changing the CBD game by offering a line of high-dose CBD tablets at an affordable price. Their products are THC-free and third-party tested for accuracy, cleanliness, and potency. Their products, which ship nationwide, include Build for CBD saturation, Boost for precision titration, and Recover for rest and rehab. With 9 years experience in hemp and fitness, Mountain Made's founders are focused on creating a quality product to help those who live an activated lifestyle. Check out mountainmade.life. Again, that's mountainmade.life to find out more about how their products can help you crush life. Remember, Their products ship nationwide. Go check out their website today and follow them on social media at Mountain Made. That's the at symbol MNTMADE. Our staff at Sound Balming uses Build before a morning workout, which helps to push our bodies to a whole new level on a daily basis. Try Build, try Boost, try Recover. Our staff is using these products to enhance our active lifestyle naturally, and we are crushing life with Mountain Made CBD. And you can too. Start today by going to mountainmade.life and ordering Build, Boost, Recover, or the multitude of other products that they have, which will enhance your lifestyle. I promise you, you won't regret it.